Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 328.
This week on the podcast, mean Pete Buttigieg is that guy you were always avoiding in your intro to political science seminar.
And Hillary Clinton accidentally sides with the Russians by reminding us that Tulsi Gabbard is a person running for president.
Plus, Mick Mulvaney shows a Giuliani-like penchant for incriminating himself. Is Giulianiness contagious?
And a U.S. brokered ceasefire in Syria benefits nobody but the dictators, those being Erdogan and Donald Trump.
Brexit is the scariest thing coming to you this Halloween.
And world leaders are spared from a tacky vacation filled with overcooked beef and gold trim by the Emoluments Clause.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
That's right.
Last week we came to you the morning of Dem debate number 4.
Yes.
Now we come to you with observations, having watched Dem debate number 4.
Here we are.
Unfortunately. I mean, I had forgotten what it was like to just watch a debate, you know, with no distractions in the comfort of my home at 5 o'clock. Because I watched the last debate in New York. I was in New York for all the other debates.
I was going to say, you've barely been anywhere. You're always... Not at home.
I'm always not at home, and I'm always in the wrong time zone because the debates start there at prime time. But here they start at 5.
And I feel like one time when you were home, I was in New York.
Yes.
Wasn't that?
We have not yet had a debate
right.
Where we just comfortably got to watch in the hours in which it would be possible to pay attention.
Yeah.
So this was exciting.
It was exciting. Yes.
And we have some takeaways from it.
Yeah.
We did live tweet it. We recommend you follow us on Twitter because we do live tweet all the debates.
Yeah. It was the biggest debate ever.
Hopefully, it was 12 people.
Hopefully it will stay the biggest debate ever
not great. You know, we thought and were right that there might be some fireworks because people really had to get their points in quickly.
Right.
It was still too many people to keep track of to the extent
and
that
and still too many hours. Somehow they all got to talk too much.
Somehow, everyone spoke too much. They didn't even give opening statements, which by the way.
Oh, dreams.
Cut those out forever.
Do that.
Nobody
always.
Has ever needed to hear an opening statement.
Right.
Or a closing statement. There's no statements really necessary in the debates. We all know who they are.
Right. The only person who probably wanted to give an opening statement was Tom Steyer because it was the first time that he had been there. So
that's
everybody
right.
was like, who's that guy? But he won't ever be there again. So we don't have
it's
to worry
fine.
About who that
no,
guy is.
No, he's qualified for the next debate.
No.
I think he either is just on the cusp of qualifying or has qualified.
3%? He's getting 3% in polls somewhere?
He bought it. He has billions of dollars, and he's been on TV every day of our lives since the beginning of time.
Oh, come on.
I'm pretty sure he's one of the 8 that's qualified.
No.
Or he's just on the cusp.
I refuse to believe it.
I mean, it's hard to believe.
Right.
It doesn't matter. Either way, he was just sort of an affable guy who agreed with everyone on everything.
I know.
So he didn't really offer anything other than seeming... That was his first debate ever in history.
Yep.
This is a man who has never debated, let alone been to a presidential debate.
Right.
And he seemed to agree that everyone seemed fine. So
yeah.
He did more to just endorse every other candidate than he did to endorse himself.
Yeah. But it really was all about Mean Mayor Pete and Amy Klobuchar versus Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
I mean, it was everybody versus Elizabeth Warren, but it was those two
that really came
specifically
to the extent that there are people, like, I couldn't tell you a single thing that, like, Castro or Harris said at this debate. I barely remember Booker, and only because he very specifically avoided the question on multiple times, you know, gave inspiring speeches about unrelated points
and
multiple
love
times.
He was her stand-in.
Exactly.
I mean, and I see what he's trying to do, but it's like he's pushing it so hard that it is like getting like hippy-dippier than I think that he thinks that it's getting. And it's like it's not it.
Well, he's trying to push himself as the unity candidate because he realizes his record sort of precludes him from being a left-wing candidate.
Well, he knew that there was going to be arguments between the left and the right.
And he wanted to be like, you guys, what if we just
all just get along?
Yeah. And it was like, no, this is, first of all, I was joking with somebody that I was having feuds with various people who I normally enjoy following during the debates on Twitter. And it was because they were sort of pulling their hair out about how contentious this debate got. And I just want to remind everyone before we begin, the whole point of the debates is to find out where they disagree, not to find out where they agree.
Right.
If they all agreed on everything, we wouldn't need 600 people to be running for president.
Right. It's like Cory Booker just wanted a 3-hour circle jerk.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like
that's not what this is for.
That's not what we're doing here.
This is to inform voters. I realize from their perspective, they would love it if they all just came out looking like heroes.
Sure.
From our perspective as voters, we are desperate to find out where they disagree because they oftentimes on the trail do not make those distinctions clear.
Right.
So that's the whole point of the debate. They need to disagree. I'm happy to have them get into an argument.
Sure.
That's what we watched for.
Yeah.
If we wanted to find out where they all agreed, we wouldn't need to waste 3 hours on a Tuesday night doing anything.
Right.
But so in any case, Klobuchar and Buttigieg were really on the attack. And it was interesting because for me, their sort of attack dog status framed them very differently. And it kind of shifted their position to me. Now, listen, these are two candidates I don't agree with on basically anything.
Yeah.
And two candidates that I do not want to be the candidate.
Yeah.
We've been clear about our hatred of Amy Klobuchar in the past.
Sure.
And we have very recently been clear, now that we know what Pete Buttigieg stands for and where his money is coming from,
yeah,
how mad we are at him.
Are we sure what he stands for? Because...
No, we're sure what he doesn't stand for. We're sure that he stands for sort of like vague proposals that mislead you into thinking they're progressive proposals but aren't.
Right.
He's a guy who is literally touting a plan called Medicare for All Who Want It.
Right.
And talking about how we can't pay for the college educations of the children of billionaires.
Yes.
He's a man who is trying to incite a weird kind of class warfare that isn't actually productive, mm-hmm, while not allowing us the kind of class warfare that asks the rich to pay their fair share in taxes.
Right.
He's bullshit. In any case, the two of them, because Pete Buttigieg has sort of been riding on a wave of seeming nice this whole,
yeah,
time. This was really the first time we saw him come out as like an attack dog.
Yeah.
And you guys, it was not a good look for him.
Yeah.
And I think I have two sort of theories on this.
Sure.
One being it went over really well with pundits.
Yes.
Which was weird.
Because I think that they felt like a lot of the pundits before the debate were talking about like that this might be his sort of like, I mean, he'll make the next debates, but sort of, right, like, he has to sort of, like, show that he can, like, mix it up with these,
yeah,
guys.
Right.
And so I think that was what they were giving him the marks for, was that he finally was just sort of, like, felt like he was kind of, like, in it to win it.
Right.
But he also felt like a giant asshole.
It diminished everything that is the cornerstone of his appeal.
Right, exactly. Which is sort of like the, you know, nice, likable mayor from the Midwest.
Right.
Right.
That he, more so than Cory Booker, I think, was sort of seen as a unity candidate and,
yeah,
you know, is not playing that game,
yeah,
right now. But also, I noticed this really broke down along gender lines really specifically, and I wonder if there is, like, something about that that is, you know, obviously we respond to all the candidates based on gendered stereotypes. We've talked about that plenty on the,
sure,
podcast. And certainly part of everyone, of our distaste for Amy Klobuchar can't just be because we disagree with her on everything. But a lot of it has to do with feeling like she's lecturing us. And I'm sure there's a gendered component to that.
There probably
even
is.
If we're not,
I'm
thinking
not
about it.
I'm not here to deny, you know, that. Yeah.
Exactly. Pete Buttigieg, though, seems like that guy. He seems like a guy you knew in college that you avoided like the fucking plague because he would mansplain your own expertise to you.
Yes.
If you had just written a paper on, I don't know, like Latin American revolutions, to name,
right,
subjects I wrote a lot of papers on. Pete Buttigieg is a guy whose area of, you know, academic interest is Hungary, but still explains Latin American revolutions to you.
Right.
Like, he's that guy.
Yeah.
And he came across as that guy. And it was really stark because he was arguing with Liz Warren, who not only seems sort of like eminently calm, but is also like an actual professor.
Yeah.
It just he seemed like that argumentative guy in your college class that argues down the professor,
yeah,
without knowing what he's talking about.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what he did here.
Yeah. It did seem to me like this could be, as annoying as that debate was, I do think that it could be sort of like the beginning of a sea change.
Yeah.
Not because I see either of those two sort of like all of a sudden like swooping up to the front. I'm talking about Klobuchar or
Buttigieg.
But it did seem like Biden really was a complete non-factor
in this
debate.
Irrelevant person in this
debate. At all. And it seems like if you are the type of person that is like looking for a moderate, I don't know that there's enough people who are actually looking for that to make a difference.
Those people are all looking for someone they think, quote unquote, can win. None of them are looking for someone who shares with those principles.
It does seem like it would not shock me if weeks from now there were more people leaving Biden and going to one of those two. Now, up until now, the people who have been leaving Biden have been going to Warren. We were just talking about that. But I mean, I could see a world where somebody looking for a strong moderate is going to jump ship from some folks, and you could start to see something that looks more sort of like closer to a 4 or 5 way race. I don't think there's enough votes for those two out there.
No.
But I do think they will probably move up. probably not enough to threaten anyone.
Yeah.
But it all depends on sort of like what happens to the 30% of people who are currently supporting Joe Biden.
They're also offering two extreme versions of the same brand of Midwestern politics. 100%. So the two of them are kind of each other's problem in a certain respect. But I have been saying all week that as much as I dislike Amy Klobuchar for many reasons, I actually would prefer that she be the primary moderate candidate in the race, because I think then we get to have a discussion that is like a smart person discussion. Like, Biden has not been adding any intellect to this debate cycle.
No,
he is not able to explain what his platform is. He is not able to explain why his moderate proposals are better than the progressive proposals that are coming from Warren and Sanders.
He's not even able to explain why his own son might have been wrapped up in this Ukraine situation.
He's not able to apologize for anything. So even though, sure, is it his fault that his son is wrapped up in the Children of Aristocrats world? That, like, not directly, but like also you could find a way to apologize for this being brought into the race or something. Like, there are so many ways in which he is like ill-equipped to add any like intellectual rigor to this debate.
Yeah.
And I think Buttigieg is trying, but he's immature and he often doesn't really know what he's talking about. And I can say that specifically on healthcare. Because he truly doesn't know what he's talking about on healthcare. And maybe there are other issues where he sort of understands them a little better. But I think on a lot of the sort of hallmark issues, he is not able to articulate what his actual point of view is on these.
Well, and it was funny, too, because after that debate, you know, there was that tweet circulating. I think I sent it to you at one point that was like from 2 years ago, where sort of like he got pressed after some event that he did about Medicare for All because he was a candidate now, and he like made some like sort of like snooty remark about like, yes, I, Pete Buttigieg, as a candidate, you know, full-throatedly say that I stand for Medicare for All and Medicare for All only, blah, blah. So he's like, he's got like a recent history of being on both sides of this issue anyway. Or if he would try and explain that away as not being on both sides of the issue, then then it's equivocating or not understanding.
Exactly.
It. Yeah.
Whereas Klobuchar, I think, actually just has a different perspective than I do on this issue.
Yes.
I think she does not believe that we should socialize public programs, and that that is her actual like political philosophy.
Well, and she was sort of articulating that, and she said it in response to Warren a few times actually, where she was, and I think it was actually a good moment for her. Obviously, again, we disagree, but like, you know, sort of pointing out that it's like, if I don't have the same plan as you, it's not because I am looking to have a worse plan.
Right.
Like,
right.
You know what
that
I mean?
I believe that my plan is better than your plan.
Right.
But she's the only person on the moderate end right now who I think has the ability to articulate an actual differing political perspective in a way that is not logical in the sense that I think it makes any sense, but is logical in the sense that like a person might agree with her.
Yeah.
And the rest of them don't seem to have that ability.
Yeah.
So I think in some senses, not from the perspective of finding a candidate that is, you know, meets the sort of quote-unquote likability factor, because I don't think her or Buttigieg merit on that count at this point. And Biden is only likable and has no other qualities. But just in terms of finding a candidate who, like, offers some kind of intellectual, you know, opposition to the Warren, you know, conversation.
Yeah.
Like, she's really the best that the moderates could hope for on that count. So it would be more interesting as a campaign if she was the moderate front runner. I don't think she will be, because like I said, she rubs everyone the wrong way.
She does.
But it certainly would be more interesting to me than listening to Biden bumble his way through this and then take credit for everything.
Or Pete Buttigieg mansplain everything
to me, including my own areas of expertise. Because that is what it feels. Also, side note, completely unrelated to everything. Did you realize that Tulsi Gabbard is younger than Pete Buttigieg?
Isn't that wild?
I mean, what a world. What a world. And why does no one talk about that with her, but we all talk about his age? That seems like a real opposite of the gender norm, you know, like.
Yeah, right? I know.
Normally, I feel like
we should be talking about how young and inexperienced she is,
right? Yeah, I'm like kind of surprised. They're both veterans. Like,
I think it's just because we've decided that we don't care about her.
I think it's that, and also because he looks like an actual child.
He's
like got man-child syndrome.
He does.
Which is a syndrome we've discussed before on this podcast many times. But she has like a gray streak, so she seems like she's ageless.
Exactly.
Meanwhile,
Bernie Sanders was
tearing it up.
I mean, we were wondering how he was going to do, how he was going to be feeling, how he was going to be looking, and the answer was
sounded great. Made all the points that were the right points.
Yes.
Managed to save Liz Warren's ass a few times.
Yep.
Managed to sort of promote his vision in a really articulate way multiple times, at times that were both on topic and made sense, whereas no one else seemed to be able to stay on topic.
Yeah, well, that's what I think. And also, for him, staying on topic sometimes is almost not staying on topic, in the sense that sort of like his whole thing is sort of like tying everything back to, you know, sort of inequality and, you know, the class warfare kind of, you know, I mean,
when you can tie any issue to that.
And you can tie any issue to that. And I think to a certain degree, I think probably what his plan was going into this debate and having taken 2 weeks off, it was good for him, I think, because I think to a degree, it sort of like probably put him back to basics to a certain degree. And I think that like he was the most sort of like clear-eyed that he had been in any of those debates, certainly. Yeah. I mean,
he really came across as the candidate with the clearest vision.
100%.
Which had not been the case before because he was ranting all over the stage and his voice was going hoarse and he didn't know what was going on with him. Like, there's 2 weeks off to recover from his heart attack.
From a heart attack.
Really sure. Did it for him.
Yeah.
And he also came in with some momentum because it got announced right before the debate that AOC was about to endorse him, that Ilhan Omar was going to endorse him, that Rashida Tlaib was going to endorse him. Like, so suddenly the squad was there, and that was the specter that kind of hung over that debate, was everyone knew the squad was about to endorse him.
CNN wondered if maybe they were too urban to help him. Did you see that?
That's cute.
Which is hilarious because, like, the knock on his campaign is that it's just, you know, a bunch of white Bernie bros.
Yeah. No.
So it's like a bunch of young women of color can't help him because they're too urban.
They're terrible about his campaign.
The press about his campaign is just.
It's so weird. Garbage. And because if you think about who were the rising political stars that came out of his campaign, it was all women of color.
I know.
It was literally only women of color because even not on the candidate side, you still had, like, Nina Turner, Simone Sanders, like all of these people who came out of his campaign initially, they were all women of color.
I know.
So I can't think of a single, like, rising star who can attribute their success to Bernie Sanders or to their early support of Bernie Sanders who was, like, a white man.
Yeah.
Those guys don't want Bernie Sanders to be the president.
I know.
Anyway, that's always curious to me. But Biden, in his one moment of having a memorable moment, managed to have it only because he did a classic Biden and, like, took credit for Elizabeth Warren's achievement.
Yes.
Elizabeth Warren was talking about the founding of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That was a bureau that she proposed and started under the Obama administration to protect consumers. And that's her area of expertise. And so she was talking about the sort of, they asked them about, like, a success that they had or something. And so she was talking about how founding that was a big success. And then Joe Biden basically was like, well, we gave you that.
Yes.
I helped deliver you the votes for that.
Yeah.
And she was like,
I'd like to thank President Obama for supporting me. there's no proof that that is actually the case.
No.
He did not work on that.
Also, helping her deliver votes for a thing that was her idea and relied on her academic expertise is not you giving it to her.
No.
It's just you helping out.
Also, and that was your job at the time.
Exactly.
Also.
Yeah.
You didn't go out of your way to do something.
No. You weren't like, stop everything. We need to get Liz Warren, this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You were like, oh, I'm the vice president. Yeah. And the whole reason I'm here is to deliver fucking
And then
votes.
He was also really patronizing to her because he was like, well, you did a good job at your job.
Yeah. I was like, thanks, Joe Biden.
Yeah. You I know I did.
You didn't, apparently. there were continuing attempts, and this question gets asked at every single debate, and I continue to be annoyed by it. It's all an attempt to get Liz Warren and Bernie Sanders to say that under Medicare for All, your taxes will go up.
Right.
So once and for all, the reason...
It doesn't bother Bernie.
It doesn't bother Bernie to say that because his supporters know that taxes are going to go up under his plans, and so he's like, fuck it, yeah. But what ends up happening with Liz Warren is she's trying to avoid having a soundbite of her saying, yes, taxes will go up on the middle class. So what she's saying is, and she's not wrong, costs will go down. But she never uses the word taxes in her answer. And it starts to sound like she's avoiding the question. Whereas the answer to the question is this. Your taxes might go up, but your overall costs will go down.
Right.
That's
she just won't. She doesn't want to use the word taxes in a sentence.
Your taxes might go up. Because that will get cut into a campaign commercial and she knows that. So someone has advised her, don't say that. Whereas Bernie Sanders is like, fuck it. Your taxes might go up. Fuck off.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. Bernie Sanders is sort of long past caring about that
because
he's been dinged for that. He's going to be dinged for that no matter what happens.
Yeah.
Warren is still playing a slightly different game than him because she's slightly more sort of broadly. She has a broader tent at the moment than he does. And so she kept saying your costs will go down. I won't sign a bill where costs won't go down for the middle class.
And the moderators and Pete and Amy were not having it.
But the problem is the premise of that question is wrong.
Yeah.
Because the premise of the question shouldn't be just taxes. It is costs that matter. It's not taxes that matter. If your taxes went up $1 billion, but your costs went down $3 billion as a household, you would have $2 billion.
That's it.
That's a lot of money that you, other instead of a debt of $1 billion. That's, like, it's the math is only important insofar as it affects your total costs.
Yeah.
And to not include total costs when you talk about healthcare is insane because of the small ways in which the reason Americans go bankrupt over healthcare all the time is not just because of the monthly cost of paying a premium. It is because there are a zillion costs associated with healthcare that end up slowly eating away. There's co-pays.
Yeah.
There's co-insurance. There's a weird hospital bill for an ambulance that wasn't contracted with your network. There's all sorts of ways in which your quality of care is affected and also your costs are affected. So this isn't even the right question. It's a Republican question.
Yeah.
And every debate they ask it.
Well, and I wish that...
Fuck off.
And Bernie got the closest to this.
Why can't they ask will costs go down?
Well, I know. And also, you know, what I wish that she would do, and Bernie did this, I think, in probably one of the best moments of the debate.
He had a real star moment.
Where I want her to, I mean, not seem like she's dodging the question. So she needs to get a better answer. But also... she needs to ask both of those two who were pestering her about this what they intend to do to actually get the cost down for people. Because right now, they're, you know, Amy Klobuchar, who knows
they're not proposing anything.
Who knows what her plan even is? I mean, she's talking about, I think, basically just sort of like redoing Obamacare from what I can tell. Pete has this cockamamie, you know, Medicare for all who want it. But I mean, it's really sort of like, what about the tens of millions of people who are already underinsured? What about the people who are going
bankrupt? What about the 30 million people who don't have insurance?
What about the costs of prescription drugs? And are we going to actually deal with those things?
Right.
Because those are the things that are causing people to be paying through the nose every month. It's not their taxes.
No, exactly.
So, and like, I think she needs to take
needs
a
to
Bernie
go
cue on this one. I think yes.
On that.
Like, because, put them in their place.
And also,
because people are getting fucked, and under their plans, they're not going to get less fucked.
Exactly. And also, she needs to be able to explain what we have been explaining on this podcast, what I successfully explained to Brent just the other week, why a public option is not enough, why that actually increases costs for everybody.
Yeah.
And that plan could be a poison pill. And someone needs to be talking about why you want to go for the quote-unquote extreme of Medicare for All and leapfrog over the quote-unquote compromise.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that's being well articulated. And that really is an important point.
Yeah.
There is a big difference between going halfway and all the way on this issue. And as I've said, I don't think going what they think is halfway is actually going backwards, in my opinion. So there is a lot of leeway for what they're proposing to make everything worse.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. They need to be asking, okay, specifically, what does your plan do to lower costs? Is your plan feasible? Because... right now, nothing is feasible. Only getting rid of Obamacare seems feasible right now. So is your plan more feasible than my plan? What are the specific things? And who do you think is going to vote for them?
Yeah.
Anyway, if anyone needs our advice on healthcare policy, we're like fucking experts. We're happy to talk messaging.
Yes.
Meanwhile, so the debate was a mostly just taken up by Tom Steyer's ugly tie. And then it ended. The one thing that we agreed with Meghan McCain on that night was how ugly Tom Steyer's Christmas time was.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I mean...
And speaking of Meghan McCain, it seems like the only thing that all 12 Democratic candidates could actually agree on was their love of John McCain.
Oh, my God. They got asked about an unlikely friendship, which was a weird question.
I knew as soon as... First off...
I knew John McCain was going to be...
First off, they framed it. They started talking about Ellen, and I was like, good. Let's all 12 of them tell Ellen to go fuck off.
Yes.
Because that's what I was hoping.
Sure.
And then they turned it into talk about why you love someone that would be surprising. And then it just, all 12 of them just talked about how great and wonderful their dear friend John McCain was.
Here's the thing, you guys. Another thing we've talked about a lot on the podcast is which Republicans would make fun dinner companions and which wouldn't. John McCain was well known to be a popular guy in Washington. He was a popular guy on the dinner party circuit. The Clintons were friends with him. Everyone was friends with him.
So it's not that surprising that you may have been friends with him.
I'm sure the McCains would be super fun to have dinner with. They're a spunky bunch.
Yeah.
In the same way that, like, the Trumps would be boring to have dinner with because they're not interesting people, you know? But, like, Lindsey Graham would be a fun dinner party guest.
Sure.
Do I want to have to be near Lindsey Graham? No. But if I had to have dinner with a Republican, I wouldn't – it wouldn't be upset if it was him, you know? Like, this does not – this opportunity that they always take, it's like how moderate Democrats will often find a reason to compliment Reagan. And right. I'm just like, stop trying to appeal to the middle by telling me that someone who destroyed the economy
right.
or who had just like bad ideas in general right. is a great person.
Yeah.
And also, let's stop lionizing John McCain for saving Obamacare. That was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
But we shouldn't just be congratulating people for doing the minimal right thing that you can do when they have a long career of often doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Like, fuck off, everyone.
Yeah.
But in any case, yeah, that was just like the end of the debate was just a conversation about how wonderful John McCain is, which yep. is not where you wanted that debate to end.
No.
Meanwhile, in the aftermath of the debate, Bernie Sanders went on to hold the largest Democratic event of the season so far.
Yep.
28,000 people went to go see him in Queens, my mother included.
Amazing.
The pictures are fun. AOC yep. endorsed him at the rally.
Yep.
Also, New Yorkers just like Bernie Sanders. I don't know what to say about that, you guys.
Well, he's a New Yorker.
He's a New Yorker. People kind of get him there. And also, I feel like the kind of people who go to a Bernie Sanders rally in New York are the kind of people that also like each other. So it's like a nice crowd. Like my mom said when she went and saw him in Washington Square Park in 2016 or 2015 or whatever.
Yeah.
She was like, it was so nice. Like people were like giving me their coats and their hats. Like people asked me if I wanted to sit. Like people were willing to help sure. me get out of a crowd if I needed to. Like everyone was just willing to help.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like, she was like, I'm going to go back because it's just like a nice group of people sure. that go and support Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
So, but I have been surprised, like my parents, and this to me reads as an indication of how sort of like progressive boomers are reading Sanders, are like back in for Sanders right now.
I know.
Like they are very into Sanders.
That. I love it.
And I've been feeling like pretty into yeah. Sanders right now. In a way that I've been a little surprised by, because I mean, obviously I've been harping on Liz Warren running for president for like yeah. a million years at this point,
yeah.
since about 2013.
Yeah.
And I'm excited that, I mean, you know,
sure.
still excited about the Warren campaign.
Yeah.
But I've been really finding myself just like in it, into the Sanders thing right now.
You can continue to love both of them.
That's what I'm planning to do. I'm going with both.
Yeah. I like it.
I feel like Sanders appeals to the purist in me, and Warren appeals to the person who wants to at least tip their hat to electability in me. And I know that sounds
right.
crazy because a lot of people are claiming like she's unelectable.
Yeah.
I think she's like imminently electable.
Sure.
Like my read on her is that she's like incredibly electable.
Yeah.
And Sanders, I feel like I have more concerns about his broad electability, but like the purist in me is really pleased by his platform.
I know. Yeah.
In any case.
There was a weird debate that happened this week.
After the debate, yeah.
between someone who was not running for president and someone who was polling at 1%.
That's right.
So it was a curious thing that happened because it really took up a lot of airspace in
and
the primary
really
this week.
It promoted the resident 1% poller.
I am
in
so
a way that was curious.
This put me into such a rage, but you know how I feel. Anytime I see a headline about Hillary Clinton, my rage level rises. And look, you know. Maybe that's a problem.
Right.
Add that to my list of political things that I need to speak to my therapist about.
Right.
My hatred of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
It's there. It exists. I can't help it. It's not going away.
That's right.
But this specifically was
stupid.
Mind-bogglingly stupid.
It was stupid. It was incredibly stupid. And it was as if she's like not a professional
right.
at
and,
media stuff.
And even if she's right.
Doesn't matter if she's right. She did the wrong
thing
with the right information.
Stupid. Right. I would say if she is right, that makes it more stupid.
That's right.
Because what she did this week was say that Tulsi Gabbard is a Russian plant.
Right. Is essentially being used by the Russians to plot a third party run to siphon votes off from the Democratic candidate. Now, leaving aside the fact that we, I think, for a long time have been espousing our issues with the DNC sort of idea that third party candidates are A, inherently problematic to the process, and B,
yeah.
are quote unquote siphoning votes off.
Right. You know who siphoned more votes from anyone in 2016?
Gary Johnson.
It was Gary Johnson who got almost 4 million votes. Jill Stein got just over 1 million votes.
Yeah.
By the way, no one was panicked about Gary Johnson.
Everyone.
Those were probably mostly Trump voters. Now, I understand that there are some sort of Democrats, especially ones
yeah.
who just want to be smoking a lot of marijuana.
Gary Johnson was more likely to pull the kinds of voters the DNC was going after than Jill Stein. Jill Stein was pulling voters that were so far on the left that
right.
they were either not going to vote or they kind of don't, you know, are not into the DNC thing.
A person who also ran in 2012 and we didn't have to care about because we didn't have a garbage candidate at the top of the ticket.
But we constantly, and this, you know, this is an ongoing problem with us where we constantly blame low polling third party candidates for election woes that were actually just us running idiots.
I mean, Tulsi Gabbard is a person who is getting 1%, between 1 and 2% of only the Democrats are currently paying attention right now.
Right.
Which is a low number of actual humans living in this country.
That's right.
And also, she's the new favorite person on, she's like the face of Fox News right now.
Yeah.
So like, if she's going to do anything, she's going to pull as many Trump supporters as she is.
She's in a very Gary Johnson-ish position where 100%. She's incredibly moderate. She has kind of a bizarre amalgam of views a la like a Rand Paul type candidate.
Totally.
So she makes no fucking sense.
And
that kind of candidate is not siphoning votes off from the Democrats. She is just siphoning weirdos off from everyone.
That's it. That's what's exactly what she's doing.
But if you give her enough publicity and you raise her, you know, you elevate her position to the extent that people who aren't paying attention to her because she's not important are suddenly hearing about her and those people are dissatisfied with everything, then you've really handed her a golden opportunity she didn't have before.
Right, because what she did, you know, maybe she's just a better politician than Hillary Clinton is.
I mean,
because she saw this as a golden opportunity.
It was.
To get votes from people who hate Hillary Clinton. I am not alone, by the way.
No, a gift that just fell directly in her lap for no reason.
So she called her in a response. She said, she's the queen of warmongers, embodiment of corruption, and personification of the rot that has sickened the Democratic Party for so long.
She did not mince words.
To which a lot of people on my Facebook, which is a small sampling of people on Earth, gave her a real slow clap for that. I had so many people, well, not so many, but I had multiple people that only that I am friends with, like that I happen to notice, say that they were donating to her for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
There were like multiple people just being like, this was the only headline that she's had since 6 months ago and when she entered the race.
Here's the thing. She could have had zero headlines.
She could have had zero
headlines. This week could have been a week free of Tulsi Gabbard news.
That's right.
And Hillary Clinton made sure it was not.
That's right.
Hillary Clinton made sure that this week Tulsi Gabbard's campaign made more money than they'd ever made.
She also said, it's now clear that this primary is between you and me. Don't cowardly hide behind your proxies. Join the race directly.
Gabbard loves a really salacious tweet. She's like Trump in that regard.
Yeah.
She likes to really, she doesn't mince words on her Twitter.
Yeah.
But the problem was Clinton gave Gabbard an opportunity to call her out for what she is without having to address her own ridiculous platform.
Right.
Because this then became a conversation about what the Hillary wing of the party is up to, which is nonsense. And Gabbard suddenly got to be the mouthpiece of the rage everyone has been feeling towards that wing
DNC
of the party
and
towards the DNC and towards this sort of moderate pussyfooting around, not going to start an impeachment inquiry, in bed with Wall Street wing of the party.
Right.
Which Clinton is sort of like the symbol of.
Yes.
And her loss is this symbolic kind of like defeat that ideology.
Of that.
She just handed her an opportunity to turn
to
her campaign
run against that.
Into that.
Yeah.
And what she was running on was nonsense. So to give her an opportunity to run on something that isn't nonsense is an insane move.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this was
such a dumb.
I mean,
dumb,
just don't mention her.
Do. Yeah.
Just do like don't. First of all, don't get back into the petty politics of third-party runs.
Right.
Stay away from that. Tell people what you're going to do for them. Tell people why your platform makes sense. Explain to those people why they should vote for you and not against Trump. And don't worry about third-party candidates.
Yeah.
There are always going to be third-party candidates.
You know what else you shouldn't be doing? Speaking in public in front of a microphone.
That's right.
Like,
not
haven't
this...
we... Weren't you canceled?
Canceled. Fully. Yeah, she's like the Donald Trump of never going away. Like, Donald
Goodbye.
Trump...
Goodbye! Like, we've...
Is a man who has snatched defeat out of the jaws of victory multiple times and gotten a TV show.
And I get that she thinks that she has been sort of, like, prescient on a lot of this Russian interfering. Because she has been. And I will give her that. And I think that she thinks
that she...
has not been
prescient on it.
Well,
she just knew it was going on and said
it. Right,
and it was confusing to everyone else at the time because she had information the rest of us didn't have.
Right.
We know that Russia... I, by the way, didn't ever not believe her about that.
Sure.
I was just like, why are you running on this? This isn't going to be a strategy to run on.
This is not how you win this election.
This isn't how you win the election. I don't think the problem was people didn't believe her about that.
Yeah.
And certainly we don't need her voice on this issue any longer because Congress has now taken up the issue.
Right.
It just, I mean, not as much as you would hope.
Yeah.
But It also gave all the weirdos in the race a chance to support Gabbard, which is only further elevating the popularity.
Like, the actual like politicians sort of like steered like, clear this had nothing of to do answering with, because yeah. that's what
there
you
was
do as a
great
but...
side eye meme from Cory Booker's campaign that people really loved.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I mean, again, it said nothing.
Correct.
Which is his move.
Yeah. But Yang tweeted that Gabbard is a veteran and she deserves much more respect and thanks than this. And Marianne Williamson said the character assassination of women who don't toe the party line will backfire. Stay strong at Tulsi Gabbard. You deserve respect and you have mine.
Right.
So there was some of that going on, from a couple nobodies. But regardless, it just seemed like whenever you have people who are in the race running against you, rushing to your support.
Yeah.
That's not it. That's not it.
No. This is... And especially people who have, like, a viral kind of support.
Totally.
Like, Yang and Williamson have, like, fan bases.
Right. Like, you don't need the Yang gang, like, coming to Tulsi Gabbard's defense.
No. Because they understand the internet.
Right.
Which is a thing that Hillary Clinton has never quite grasped. She has one person who tweets clever tweets from her account.
Right.
And that is all she has.
Right.
And just let yourself do that.
Yeah.
Sometimes she has a snappy remark.
Sure.
That's great. People are retweeting those. People love those. That's fine. Be a person who has snappy remarks on Twitter. Don't get in front of a microphone.
Yeah.
Certainly don't try to use this as an example to explain away your own loss. Because that's what I feel like a lot of this, it would be one thing if some random person who hadn't just lost the race for president in like a year where it was like handed on a golden platter to her
right.
could have said this and we might have been like, well, maybe, I don't know. We've been talking about the potential Russian interference in Gabbard's campaign already because of the number of yard signs we saw in Iowa.
Right.
Because there's just like a lot of weird campaign stuff going on with
Hillary
campaign.
Clinton didn't invent this idea.
No, we've been all talking about this idea for a while. But this, with Clinton saying it, and especially with her sort of like turning it into a discussion of third party candidates. It sounds like she's just trying to make excuses for why she fucking lost.
She's just crying
again
about 2016.
Yeah,
that's what
it's like,
fuck off. Yeah, yeah, yep.
And also, somebody is going to run as a third party candidate, possibly multiple people.
Yeah.
It happens every time.
Because that's what happens.
That's what happens.
It's called an election
in the United States. In elections, people run for president in those. And sometimes those people aren't from the two major parties. And as much as Democrats may be frustrated by that, I'm frustrated that Republicans run for president. But we have to let it happen. That's what democracy is. Like, there's plenty of people that I'm frustrated to see running for president.
Yeah.
But I know that part of the process is that we have to convince voters that our person is better than that person.
That's right.
That's what the job is.
Yeah.
The job is not to just whine because people had the audacity to run in a democracy for president. Anyway. Meanwhile,
Another debate.
Liz
Lots
Warren has really taken on Facebook in a direct way in the last week, and it's been kind of exciting.
It has been.
She basically ran ads trolling Facebook on Facebook.
So good.
To prove that they will allow any fake news to be published on Facebook because Trump's campaign spent $1 million on ads spreading misinformation.
Right. I mean, they're just full of lies and everyone knew they were full of lies, but like Facebook is not caring about that.
Yeah. And these campaign ads, I mean, these ads that Facebook is running were all about Biden too. They weren't about her.
Oh, yeah.
She was just doing this to show like anyone can lie on Facebook.
Right.
And she wants Facebook and other, you know, major social media platforms to be regulated like utilities.
Right. And so that's sort of like what happened because she released this plan to like break up big tech and it was going to target companies that earn $25 billion or more, excuse me, in global annual revenue. And Zuckerberg then sort of like in private remarks that he was thinking that we're going to stay private.
Right. He should know better.
Right. Said he called it an existential threat. He said if she gets elected president that I would bet we will have a legal challenge, and I would bet that we will win that legal challenge. He also, I can't remember what else.
Then
he said
some like Facebook sort of like Live event where all of the comments were positive.
No,
did you see that?
No, I didn't.
There was because after this, he gave a speech at Georgetown. After this, where he continued to
like
kind of harp
week.
On this
right.
this week, but he also did this like Facebook Live speech where the comments, Facebook says the comments were unmoderated, and I think I actually believe them because the comments were so weird that it sounded like they were coming from bots. Basically, every single comment on the Facebook Live speech or event or whatever it was, the Q&A, I don't know what he was doing, was just like, we love you, Mark Zuckerberg. Go. Facebook has changed my life. It was
like
stuff like that.
Said no one ever.
Said no one ever. said, it's like having rabid Joe Biden supporters on your Facebook feed. Like, that's not a thing that happens.
Yeah.
And so that was weird. So it kind of sounds like Russian bots are not only interfering to help Tulsi Gabbard become the president, but also to help Mark Zuckerberg make lots of money.
Yeah.
To continue to spread misinformation. Yeah.
But he, in that speech, he basically was like, we're going to continue to stand for free expression and blah, you know, and just basically be like, anybody can say anything they want on Facebook was pretty much like what the point of this speech was that he gave at Georgetown. And so Warren responded to that speech and she said, Mark Zuckerberg's speech today shows how little he learned from 2016 and how unprepared Facebook is to handle the 2020 election. So these two are not afraid of having a public spat.
No.
And I think she probably think that's a winning argument for her, and I think she's probably right.
I think she's right. I think this is the – I think everyone inherently knows that Facebook is not the same as public speech.
Yeah.
You know, because it's a private company moderating your public speech.
Right, exactly.
And a private company owning the information that is your public speech. So it's not the same as me going into the middle of the street right now and saying a bunch of lies.
And it's an advertising platform.
It's also an advertising. I mean, exactly. And it's one thing also for us to have free speech in that Brent and I could get on public access television and say anything we want, whether or not it's true. No one can stop us from doing that. But it's another thing if we are accepting money for those lies. That is an exchange. That's not the same, really, as public speech. When it, if it's housed on a private platform and the private platform is making money for the speech, then what we're talking about is truth in advertising, which is something that's regulated.
Correct.
You know, you're not allowed to have a fake chicken in your chicken commercial. You have to be cooking an actual, you know, you can undercook the chicken, you can spray paint the chicken probably. I mean, you can do all sorts of things to make the chicken look delicious, but you have to have a real chicken in your chicken commercial. If you are, you know, doing a commercial for ice cream, which I know because my dad shared a food studio, he shared a studio with food photographers for a long time, and they had a bunch of ice cream accounts. And you have to use real ice cream in your ice cream ads. And so they had to have a million things of ice cream because ice cream melts instantly.
Sure.
And they were under hot lights, and so they were taking pictures. So they had to have a lot of ice cream available, which meant we got a lot of ice cream at the end of the day, which was a win for everyone. but there are things that prevent you from, you know, we have regulated advertising.
Correct.
We have regulated for-profit speech.
Yes.
So this is that. This is not free speech.
They're just advocating themselves. I mean, they're like, they don't want to mess with it because they know it's going to be hard. And guess what? It will be because Facebook is a behemoth.
That's right.
But like, they're just choosing to do nothing.
Yeah,
and exactly. And calling it free speech
is
what they're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Warren has a kind of bizarre ally in all of this, which is one of the co-founders of Facebook.
Yeah.
The one who hates Mark Zuckerberg.
So, maybe Chris not
Hughes.
That odd of an ally, but yeah.
He co-chairs an organization called the Economic Security Project, and they just created a $10 million anti-monopoly fund.
Right, but he has like recently called Mark Zuckerberg, said that the amount of power that he has is un-American.
Yeah.
That is, that's an interesting sort of like a duo.
You know who's not going to come out against Facebook's monopolizing speech?
I do. Pete Buttigieg.
That's right. Why is that?
Because he's taking all of their money.
That's right. I mean, all of big tech.
All of big tech.
If you're wondering why he has so much money as a person who's random.
It's big tech.
It's tech.
They
it's tech
are money. Really going for him right now. And he's also like friends with Mark Zuckerberg.
Right.
Like they were at Harvard together. That's not to say that they were friends at Harvard. But like Mark Zuckerberg went to South Bend and like did a tour of
Facebook
the city.
Live tour.
And then they did like a bunch of Facebook Live videos like while they were driving around in Pete's car like through South Bend. And like real like chummy. And
this is also, I feel like for a long time, there's been something that we have known in California that maybe the rest of the nation has not had to deal with in the same respect, which is tech gets a sort of reputation for being like a really forward-thinking and creative industry. And because of that, I think a lot of people think it's progressive because it's young people and they're doing kind of new technology kind of jobs.
Right.
Tech's interests do diverge with yours at a certain point.
For sure.
And it is when they start having this kind of money. So tech initially might have been a bunch of young idealistic people trying to solve the world's problems via tech. And because of that, a lot of them seemed like they shared values with you.
Yeah.
But we are at the point where tech's values have diverged with yours. So we know this in California because tech puts dumb props on the into our prop system, which, as we've explained many times, is 1,000 props per election. And, you know, a lot of the time that money will come from only one or two sources. So we have a big problem with rich people in California getting to essentially make their own law by having enough money to propose a prop and then get it on the ballot and then pay for the campaign for it. Yeah. the rest of the country really hasn't had to deal in the same way with this kind of very specific tech influence in politics until recently. And this is, tech's interests have now diverged with yours. Pete Buttigieg is representing tech's interests, and that's not the same as your need for affordable healthcare. Right. You know, like those are two separate spheres of need.
Yeah.
And their sphere of need involves a lot of sort of aggressive pro-business strategy that does not benefit the little guy.
Right.
And so remember that. Just keep that in mind.
Yes.
Facebook isn't really your friend.
Nope.
And listen, I'm not even one of those people who's gotten off Facebook.
No, me either.
I mean, I need Facebook for work. I use it for outreach for the World Trade Center Health Program. Sure. I do a lot of stuff with Facebook that's important.
Yeah.
That said, I recognize that they don't share political interests with me. Just as, you know, I mean, even fucking IKEA doesn't share political interests with me.
Sure.
You know, like we all have to, you know, sort of participate in the world, but like we can acknowledge that this is a separate thing from our own interests.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, it's been an interesting week for Trump again. First of all, he had an insane rally this week. We're not even going to get into the quotes because it was just insane. But he did mock the idea of acting presidential during the rally, which was bizarre and did create some great sound bites for TV.
Yeah.
But the real story begins with this press conference on Thursday.
Yeah.
Well, there's two stories. There's a serious story and this story. And we will cover the serious story after this. But this story is a Thursday press conference that had two hilarious outcomes.
Right.
Mick Mulvaney is who's giving, that's the acting chief of staff in the White House. He's who's giving this, you know, this briefing in the press.
He's really messed things up for the White House.
He has really caused some trouble because during his remarks at the presser, he says very specifically that the Trump administration withheld $400 million in military aid from Ukraine to pressure them to pursue an investigation into that ridiculous CrowdStrike theory about the DNC's email servers being computer servers being taken to Ukraine to cover up that Ukraine caused the hacking instead of Russia.
Right.
This is all, it's not only a conspiracy theory, but it further proves that he's trying to cover for Russia.
Right.
And that's insane because that is Mick Mulvaney saying straight out essentially that there was a quid pro quo in that call with Zelensky.
And that is the one thing that the Republicans have been clinging to, like grasping.
Yeah.
And it hasn't even been true because I think that there have been so many instances where it was like clear that this quid pro quo was actually happening, but we hadn't sort of like had it from someone in the White House said publicly, like, you know, come out of his own face.
Here's a little literal quote from him. Did Trump also mention to me in the past that corruption related to the DNC server? Absolutely. No question about that. But that's it. And that's why we held up the money.
There we go.
He denied that the investigation had to do with Biden's son at that point.
Sure.
That's irrelevant. If you're investigating any of the
conspiracy, it
doesn't matter. That wasn't. And then the White House obviously panicked. Jay Sekulow, the other personal attorney for Trump that isn't Giuliani, released a statement right away saying that the president's legal counsel wasn't involved at all in this press briefing. And then within the hour, Mulvaney released his own statement trying to walk back what he said and saying there was never any condition on the flow of aid related to the matter of the DNC server, which is the exact opposite of what he said
in front
of everyone with his words.
It seems like maybe the president's legal counsel was directly involved because it seems exactly like the thing that the president's legal counsel has been up to.
But, I mean,
being Rudy Giuliani.
It couldn't be more on brand.
I mean,
we've said many times.
It's almost like they spoke to the president's legal counsel right before going on stage.
Exactly. It's almost as if he knew the story intimately and it followed every playbook, you know, every element of the playbook that is.
And he said word
plan.
For word what he was told to say.
Exactly. Meanwhile, the reason they were holding this press conference was not for Mick Mulvaney to destroy the reputation of the White House. It was so that they could announce that they were. Announce another scandal, essentially, which is that they were going to host the G7 conference in June.
Yeah.
At the Trump National Doral Hotel near Miami.
Yeah.
Which is one of the, it's a Trump property.
Yeah.
And that seems like it violates the Emoluments Clause.
It seems like that because it does.
Because it does. People immediately raised that point.
From both parties.
From both parties. And my mother was so livid about this in particular. She kept calling me and being like, I don't know, there's so much bad stuff going on, but for some reason I am so hung up on this fucking hotel thing. Like, she could not stop raging about that. And I was like, really? Like, children in cages? And she was like, they cannot hold a G7 meeting at Trump's property. That is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But so, in any case, not to make it sound like my mom doesn't care about kids in cages. She rants about that to me all the time. But this week was like, for some reason, this really like got her.
Yeah.
And it got a lot of people because they backed off.
They did, finally.
So they decided they're not going to host the G7 meeting there. But Trump went on a tweet storm to explain why, which is mostly him ranting about the Democratic Party and the media being crazed and irrational for their crazed and irrational hostility, and continued to say that he was, quote, doing something very good for our country and was not seeking profit.
Oh, no.
They offered to do it at cost, whatever that means. no one could possibly know.
Right.
So they're going to host, they're looking for another site. They're thinking Camp David now.
Well, obviously. I mean, just do it there.
Literally.
Come on.
Use your brain.
I know.
In any case, Thursday was a busy day.
Yeah.
Because Thursday was also the day that Pence went to Turkey to announce an agreement with Turkey to suspend their military operation in Syria and let Kurdish forces retreat from the designated safe zone. And that basically just handed a victory to Turkey.
Yes.
It was another time that we sort of snatched defeat out of the jaws of victory. Because we obviously have abandoned our allies, the Kurds.
The Kurds.
And listen, I know everyone's a kind of shady ally in this scenario.
Sure.
So I'm not trying to pretend like the Kurds aren't problematic, because right. they certainly are. But Turkey was being extra problematic. Syria is being run by a dictator.
Right.
So we're dictators on both sides.
Right.
And then we were supporting the Kurds in the middle. And instead what we decided is to just hand Turkey a victory, agree to a ceasefire that the Kurds have not agreed to. So I don't know who we think the ceasefire is between us and Turkey. Well, yeah. We were leaving anyway. So what does that mean? Nothing.
No, it doesn't.
And pretty much everyone was like, this seems like it gives Turkey just like an unmitigated victory at huge cost to the Kurds and has no other outcome.
Right, because it's a ceasefire, but they're also not under any obligation to actually withdraw any of their troops.
Right, so it's just a chance for Turkey to occupy the safe zone.
Right.
Which is not it.
No.
And pretty much everyone knows that. So yeah. It was, you know, they also basically announced that they're, you know, first of all, they called Erdogan all sorts of wonderful things. They announced how much they love Erdogan. And then, you know, celebrated how they had basically fucked over our allies in a really specific way.
Yeah.
And how that was, I don't know what it's going to do other than make everything more dangerous. And then Trump went to his rally where he was going to talk about not being presidential and celebrated right. himself a little bit.
Yeah. And also said that he likened the fight between the Turkey and the Kurds to two kids in a lot. He said, sometimes you've got to just let them fight and then you pull them apart.
What a fucking asshole.
What? So he was just like letting them kill each other for a minute just before like swooping in to get them to not kill each other for a second, but also not really solve the problem.
That's right. Okay. Of course, we also had another exciting, like earlier in the week, or around this time in the week, I can't remember when this photo got released, but this was a meeting about Syria with the congressional Democrats. This meeting at the White House happens, which, by the way, the White House requested. And then Trump got to it and was like, I didn't want to have this meeting. It was like, then who proposed it? Because you are the one who invited us here.
Right. Well, I could see him personally maybe not wanting to have had the meeting.
Right. But the meeting begins with him distributing a letter he sent earlier this week to Erdogan.
Which sounds
like it's written by a toddler.
Correct.
It literally says things such as, history will look upon you favorably if you get this done the right and humane way. It will look upon you forever as the devil if good things don't happen. And then it also says, don't be a tough guy. Don't be a fool. Like, what the hell? The letter got released and it immediately, I read it and was like, oh, the Onion has done a thing. Uh-huh. Like, it was so...
Yeah.
Comical that it was hard to, it was hard for people to believe that it was an official letter.
Yeah.
So in any case, he holds this meeting. First of all, begins it by insulting Mattis. Schumer tries to make a point about how Mattis is against his current, you know, strategy in Syria. And then he calls Mattis the world's most overrated general. Later in the week, Mattis then joked that him and Meryl Streep finally had something in common because he has called her the most overrated actress.
Right. So he called himself the Meryl Streep of generals.
Exactly. The meeting was only 20 minutes long. It included some hilarious exchanges, though. It included an exchange where Nancy Pelosi said to him, or said to Trump, all roads with you lead to Putin. Mm. It included this juvenile exchange of Trump saying, I hate ISIS more than you do, and her saying, you don't know that, and him saying, you're just a politician, and her replying, sometimes I wish you were. And then, according to the New York Times,
this is so good.
There are two accounts of what happened that ended the meeting. So according to Schumer and the White House, Trump called Pelosi a, quote, third-rate politician.
Right.
But the best part of this story is that Pelosi maintains that what he said instead was a third-grade politician.
Right.
That,
he mangled the insult.
Which is so amazing.
Either way, it led to Pelosi and House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer walking out and abruptly ending the meeting. Trump just said goodbye, we'll see you at the polls as they left.
That's right.
And then that was the end of the meeting.
To be fair, he's walked out in a huff out of their previous two meetings. Yeah. So these meetings only end with somebody walking out in a huff.
Right.
There is no other way for them to end.
It was another sort of like, I love the we'll see you at the polls.
Yeah.
It's similar to sort of like, you know, we'll see you in court.
Exactly.
We'll see you in the courts.
That's
where
right.
Where it's like, yes, you will see us at the polls. Yes, you will see us at court. You know,
right.
It's like,
thanks.
You will see us at the place where you were expected to see us.
That's right.
Being the polls.
The best part after the meeting ended of all of this, I keep saying the best part. There were so many best parts of this right. meeting. The other best part, the part that you might have heard about as a random person who wasn't following the details of the meeting, not you, Brent, but you, the world.
Yes.
Is that Trump then tweeted a picture of Nancy Pelosi pointing her finger at him and like standing up at a table of
person.
All men.
Right.
And tweeted that she was having a meltdown.
Mm, yes.
And instead, everyone saw a picture of an incredibly brave and powerful woman standing down a room full of idiot men.
Right.
Standing over Donald Trump as the tiniest person in the room.
Yeah.
And saw a hero.
And the reports that came out after that meeting, including from people who obviously remained nameless, but there was a whole report on CNN basically about like all of the people who left that meeting that were horrified at Trump's actions.
Yeah.
Like to the point where it was like they were nervous about his sanity. And, you know, we've been nervous about his sanity for a
Everyone's
long time.
Everyone's pretty nervous
but
about
I
his
mean,
sanity.
But I mean, like, there's a lot of people sort of, I think, really walking around Washington right now wondering if maybe he's more unhinged than he actually ever really has been.
I mean,
which
I feel
would
like
be a
he's
real
the
trick.
Same amount unhinged.
I think he's the same amount of unhinged,
he's
too.
He's been unhinged, you guys. He's right. not acting rationally and hasn't been for years.
He's now just unhinged about a thing that the Republicans are worried about.
Exactly.
For the first time, which
but
is
he's
upsetting.
Also
but
repeatedly given Nancy Pelosi photo ops where she looks like a hero.
Totally.
Why? Nancy Pelosi, when she stages her own photo ops, is like American Gothic with her and Chuck Schumer looking like dead people making the world's most boring announcement.
Right.
Somehow, when Trump is around, she looks like...
Yeah, she looks like an American hero.
An American hero. And this is not good for them. Like, he should stop allowing them to be photographed together because she makes him look like a fool. That's her power, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I've said repeatedly, she is, like, the most powerful just, like, presence I have ever been in front of. Like, you can see why everyone's scared of her.
Sure.
And why everyone is sort of, like, respectful to her in Congress. And I just don't... Like, he is so sort of, like, numb to the idea that, like... First of all, a woman could be this powerful, but also that anyone could challenge his, you know, sense of authority.
Yeah.
That he doesn't see how silly he looks when he's next to her.
I know.
She makes him look like a fool every time.
Yeah.
And this is a person who, by the way, like, is not doing, she's not doing well with her own base at the moment.
Right.
You know, she announced the same day as the debate at a special press conference right before the debate that the Democrats are not holding a House vote to formally start impeachment inquiries. That is something the base really wants.
They're going to keep They're going to keep moving forward with the inquiry. But one of the things that the Republicans have been saying is that they should take a vote. And they're obviously not going to take a vote on impeachment right this second.
No, but
because they
starting
don't have
a formal
to.
Inquiry.
Right. And so that if they could sort of like part of the reason why a lot of Republicans are saying that they are not going to sort of like, you know, honor these subpoenas and things like that is because like this has not been formalized.
Right.
So there has been some discussion amongst Democrats as to whether they should take a vote to formalize this inquiry.
Yeah.
And she announced that they're not going to do that. And I don't really know why, because the votes are there. This also was Tuesday. Some of this other stuff has happened a little bit later in the week.
So maybe
there have been some Republicans who have come out in a little bit more sort of like anxious way about what
they
has been
need
going
the cover.
On this week.
I have been saying this for weeks. Republicans need some cover here.
Well, that's what I feel like I saw a quote from Jeff Flake recently where he said privately up to 35 people in the Senate would vote for this.
Yeah, the cover. And this is like it's like a sort of catch 22 where they keep saying, well, the support's not there, but they're not giving anyone a chance to support it publicly
right.
in a way where they're covered.
Right.
Because you can't, once there's a formal inquiry, once they have to comply with these subpoenas, once the information is out there, the public tide is going to turn.
Yeah.
And then people are going to be able to be like, well, I stuck it out for as long as I could, but faced with this evidence, it's the same way the moderate Democrats suddenly had to be like, well, faced with this evidence, I don't know what else we can do.
Yeah.
There is a tipping point where Republicans have to do that too, even though they've been batshit insane
right.
this whole time. And that tipping point requires this to be a formal process.
Right. Well, and I think that tipping point, I think, has already begun because I think it started with that the Mulvaney press conference on Thursday.
Yeah, I agree.
So, because that's where we finally started seeing some sort of, like, wishy-washy Republicans.
Yes.
So, I have a feeling that just, it's so fast how quickly things move, that this press conference where she said that she wasn't going to have this vote on Tuesday, I think probably 48 hours later, she was rethinking maybe the
press conference. She also left it open at the press conference.
Yeah.
It was all very vague.
You know, by the time that you're listening to this podcast, she may have taken a vote. Right. I don't know.
Well, and also, there was a Gallup poll released this week that showed that 52% of Americans say Trump should be impeached and removed from office.
Right.
52%. The only other time that numbers have been that high in a Gallup poll of this nature was right before Richard Nixon resigned.
Yeah.
So we are...
Four days before he resigned.
Right. We are in Nixon territory here. And that also gets... That shows you, you are never going to find 80% of the country supporting something like this.
Right.
That's just not how it works.
Yeah.
But if a majority of Americans are supporting that the president be removed from office, then you're in pretty dangerous territory. At least start a formal inquiry.
Hello.
Come on.
God.
Meanwhile, there was also more testimony this week.
Yeah.
In the unofficial impeachment inquiry. Gordon Sondland, the ambassador to the EU, who had defied orders
from the White House to not participate.
And I hadn't realized really who he was, because who cares about the ambassador to the EU? But this guy is a hotelier from Seattle, who is a major donor to Trump's 2016 campaign.
Sure, that's how he got a job.
And basically...
He's in the swamp.
He basically wedged his way into the Ukraine issue because the Ukraine portfolio is not part of his sort of area as the EU ambassador.
Sure.
And so he, like Rick Perry, like Giuliani, kind of wedged his way into this issue and did it while sort of shutting out people who did have this as part of their portfolio. Because later in the week, George Kent, who was a deputy assistant secretary in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs and did have Ukraine in his portfolio, also gave testimony, a closed-door testimony, saying that he had basically been shut out of the issue by Mulvaney, who had a meeting in May where he basically told everyone that, you know, where basically he shut out all of the Ukraine experts and brought in Perry, Sondland, and Giuliani to kind of lead their Ukraine stuff.
Yeah.
Rick Perry, by the way, has set an official resignation date.
He has.
And so I think he's trying to get the F out of there.
And I think has also said that he is not going to, because they've subpoenaed him and he's not going
to obey the subpoena.
Yeah, I'm almost certain that I saw that.
Well, it's probably part of his deal to get out of there.
Yeah.
But so in any case, that has led. Well, and also Kurt Volker was the third amigo, they were describing. They were calling the three amigos. But so in any case, these allegations are if nothing else, really problematic for national security, but are also just getting closer and closer to Trump himself, A.
Yes.
And B, certainly closer to Giuliani himself.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, new Brexit developments.
Oh, my gosh.
Halloween's going to be exciting for many reasons.
Because Brexit is going down on the 31st come hell or high water,
it sounds like. Boris Johnson sent an unsigned letter to the EU on Saturday requesting another Brexit delay. Because Parliament passed an amendment requiring him to do that before voting on the deal that he brokered on Thursday with the EU.
But then he sent, at the same time,
sent
a second letter that he did sign saying that he believes a delay would be a mistake.
So he sent them two letters simultaneously, one asking for a delay and the second one, the more credible one, because it has his signature saying they shouldn't grant the delay.
Grant the delay.
And
because his government insisted on Sunday that Brexit is going to happen on October 31st, regardless of any of the letters that Johnson sent.
Right.
But all of the opposition MPs are like, if you do that, we will take you to court.
Right. They're going to if you're going to circumvent Parliament, who is supposed to vote on this, then we will take you to court.
Right. This all sounds like headlines I've heard in America.
It's
right?
I mean, wild what is going on there. And also,
but Boris Johnson is sort of a Trumpian character
He's a Trumpian character, and they've had this sort of same sort of foolish maneuverings going on there. But also, it's so funny to picture all of this happening in British accents.
Right.
Isn't it? Everything sounds, to American ears, British politics sounds very formal, even though it's usually a lot wilder than our own politics. But so the idea of all of these Trumpian shenanigans happening in a British accent just tickles me. I don't know. Meanwhile, and in final news, Giuliani is hopefully getting, but may not be getting, new lawyers. Because Giuliani is in a smattering of trouble all over the place.
Yeah.
He is under investigation by federal prosecutors in Manhattan.
Yep.
For his business dealings with Ukraine, his finances, sort of the Manafort-esque
sure.
parts of his life.
Yep.
He is also has admitted this week that he was paid $500,000 to work for Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, who were the two businessmen that were arrested last week on campaign finance charges
right.
that Trump has never heard of but is photographed with.
He's refusing to comply with congressional subpoenas.
Here's the thing. He is not a part of the executive branch. He's just a guy.
Yeah.
He is not able to claim executive privilege on this. No. He is the president's personal lawyer. He's not working for the American people or the executive branch.
Yeah.
So he's just some guy who's refusing to comply with a subpoena. Put that guy in jail.
Right. Yeah, seriously.
I mean, Jesus. Like,
well, yeah, they could.
We don't owe him anything.
Assuming they could, right? I mean, could they
help so.
At least hold him in contempt? I mean, like...
I think so. I mean, who is he to us? Just some yeah. guy who's not... he's breaking the law.
Yeah.
He's just a guy breaking the law.
Yep.
And then, of course, he has to find new lawyers. He either left his lawyers or his lawyers left him. I have a theory about which one it is. But also, have you noticed how, like, the Trump team is just, like, a giant circle jerk of lawyers?
Lawyers,
because
it
their
is.
Lawyers always – his lawyers always end up needing their own lawyers.
Right.
Like, Michael Cohen needed a lawyer. Like,
yeah.
They it's just an endless chain of lawyers needing lawyers to explain to other lawyers how their lawyers broke the law from – like, it's chaos. So Giuliani, parting ways with John Saul, who's his current attorney, people are telling him to get a criminal attorney,
criminal
and he's been resisting. But, dude.
Right.
Get your shit to I think maybe he can't get anyone to take the case. I wouldn't take his case.
No.
I mean, it's a losing case, first of all, plainly.
Also, you have to be around him if you're his lawyer.
You'd have to be around him. You'd have to be around people like him.
Right.
You would have to, you know, be the guy whose name goes on record supporting treasonous activities.
Well, that's what I was just about to say. You might have to be someone who is representing someone who is responsible for the downfall of America.
Right. And then you might
slash
also...
Slash civilization. I mean, like...
And listen, there are law firms in Washington who, like, will represent Saudi Arabia.
Sure.
You know, I mean, there's not honor there.
Right.
But it does feel like also in his case, you might not be able to get paid.
True.
Like, Saudi Arabia will pay.
Yeah.
So, like, I know why people take that case. I myself might not choose to.
Sure.
But I, if you are someone with no morals,
right.
that is a kind of person that exists
right.
in the Washington legal community.
Right. They'll write a good check.
They'll write a good check, and you will cash that check, and you will have a row house in Georgetown or a fancy right. house in Arlington, whatever your life is,
yeah.
And you'll have nice shoes and a watch.
Yeah.
If you take Giuliani's case, I just don't know that you necessarily do get the watch.
Right.
I think maybe you get shorted, because these people don't pay their bills.
Right.
So, in any case, I wouldn't take that case.
No.
And I would not recommend that any criminal attorney do it.
No.
I'm curious to see what happens.
It's going
to
be exciting.
Yeah.
God, can you imagine him defending himself? That's really what would be great.
At least
for television.
Yes. And not only can I imagine it, but I think it might bring them closer to their ultimate goal of just good ratings. That's
right.
what this is all about. I
right.
mean, why not commit? Go in, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, so far, Giuliani is the best ratings generator that they have over there.
Oh, totally.
I mean, and that's how
he's
they measure
really
success,
good
right? He's yeah. great television, and he
yeah.
knows it, and we know it.
Yeah.
And listen, I'll watch him be interviewed all day, because it is entertaining.
Yeah.
I don't like that about myself, but you do what you have to do.
Here we are.
Here we are. I don't see how Trump doesn't see that this is, like,
I know.
His exact cup of tea. In any case, that's the news this week. We will not be here next week, but we will be back
right.
after that. With news of whatever happens.
Brexit,
I mean,
impeachment, who knows?
Usually something crazy happens while we're gone. So
it always does.
We will talk to you then.
Bye.
Bye.